Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back. And it is now or never that debt is fraud. And we want you to continue to learn, pray, and act. And I've got a special title for today's show, and actually I'm going to put this up on the podcast page so that it'll be maybe easier for you to find, because the epiphany is overwhelming. But let me finish the two obligatories. It's all about being centered on the Constitution. And as a matter of fact, this kind of goes in line with the title of the show, which I'm still withholding until I get through the obligatories. We have to demand compliance. It is a compact. If you have a subcontractor working on your home, do you allow your subcontractor the latitude to do whatever they want? I used to use this metaphor for putting contracts into context. Let's say you go and create, you know, you create this huge, beautiful home. And now that you have this home, you need to have it landscaped. And so that's not a single-time thing, as a matter of fact, because you've got money. And you want to have the most beautiful landscaped home in all of the town because you have the money. And so you enter into a contract with whom you believe, and everybody tells you, is the best landscaper bar none. Are you going to just haphazardly create a contract? Are you going to actually have so much confidence and faith in the individual and the reputation to where you say, I want to hire you to do my yard, and I don't care what you need to do, make my yard the most beautiful yard in all of the town. And then give him the keys to your home, you know, to the, you know, the garages, everything that he might need, power, what have you. And tell him that you'll be back, you're going on a trip, because you want to, you know, entrust this person, and you'll be gone for about a month and you come back. After you come back from, you know, your trip on a month, after a month, you pull up to your house and you go, oh my goodness, look how beautiful my yard looks. Look at the sculpturing and the water effects and all of the things. And you're overwhelmed by how beautiful your yard is. But you don't care about the cost until you realize your folly in making a bad compact. Because you walk into your home, and inside your home, your furniture is gone. And you start looking around. And as a matter of fact, you forget to actually wonder where the furniture is. You're looking around and going, there's a lawnmower in here, and it's dripping oil on my floor. And there's this piles of bags of dung, you know, cow dung, and it's all stinky. And what the heck happened to my home? And so you call your landscaper, and you say, hey, Billy Bob, what the heck you do to my house? And he says, oh, well, you told me I could do whatever I needed to, and I felt that having all my stuff there and all the supplies that I needed inside your home was better for me than for me to have to, you know, truck it in all the time. So it just makes me work a little bit more efficiently in, you know, getting the lawnmower out and getting, you know, the plumbing parts and doing, because I've still got some more work I'm going to do. I mean, this guy's got big aspirations. And you gave him a blank check. The framers did not give the federal government a blank check. You have to understand this. But as long as we don't know what they gave them, then more fool us, right? So it's all about compliance to the Constitution. This goes in line with Learn, Pray, Act. We have to truly understand. Until you understand the compact, that contract that was created between the states and the federal government that didn't even exist at the time. It actually created the federal government. In other words, the creature is the creation of the states. And it's the same thing. The states are a creation. It's a creature of the counties. And the county government is a creature of we the people. If you understand the hierarchy, then you start understanding the importance of what we delegated for them to do. And maybe we realize that most of the problems are our fault. So, again, with all of the Learn, Pray, Act, focusing on the Constitution, if you want to start seeing changes in the election and actually go back towards an electoral college selection of the president instead of a popular vote, because we have a popular vote. Don't let the people out there tell you that they just want to close the door on the electoral college, fool you, because they already did. They have been getting away with the popular vote since the 1850s. Okay, so here's the thing. The title for today's show is basically, as I like to put it, how, or the irony, let's just call it this way, because I kind of typed it out this way. The irony of conservative thinking versus informed thinking, and how conservative thinking will accept tyranny in contrast to informed thinking. So today I'm going to actually finish the preemptive act, and then I'm going to dive into the Indiana and the, what's the next state after that? Mississippi Enabling Acts. We had recently covered the Louisiana Enabling Act. And what I do is I prove to you that when Louisiana, a foreign state, truly it was a foreign state and it only became a part of the United States as a territory in 1803. And only 9 years later, it becomes its own state because there were that many people. It was that developed. And there were no stipulations. It came into the state with full equal footing. There were no holdbacks. They couldn't apply the Northwest Ordinance. And this is where I get to poke people in the eye. You've heard me say, how many conservatives out there look at the 14th Amendment as this evil undoing of our Constitution? And I am here to poke in the eye that the divine hand of providence had just as much involved and inspiration into that amendment as he did in the Constitution. I will tell you that he even gave us gifts within the 16th and 17th Amendments. Because when we start looking at those, we realize that they didn't actually do what the progressives intended, but what the progressives intended ended up becoming more of a narrative in brainwashing us to believe that the way they've implemented it is legitimate. Bottom line, we have to understand those things enumerated in the Constitution as well as in the amendments. It's only when we read these things where we go, oh my goodness. They don't have the power to take away the state's equal suffrage in the Senate through the 17th Amendment. How did this happen? Well, they misinformed us, and that's why the difference between a conservative thinking patriot, you know, somebody that considers themselves conservative thinking, is causing more problems because they accept the government as it is, and they just want a conservative side of tyranny. Oh, well, as long as we got the Bible in our schools, then that's a good thing. You know, our federal school system. No, having a federal school system is wrong. I don't care what you put in your schools, but having a federal school system is wrong. And using the federal government to solve your problems, whether it is marriage, whether it is education, whether it's housing, whether it's energy, they don't have the authority to do it. Why are we surrendering our sovereignty and letting them do these things? Okay, so as we wrap up the Preemptive Act, because this really kind of started exposing things, and it really started with the Utah Enabling Act. When I wrote Why Counties Matter Most and published it a year ago, basically it's been out a year, and if you haven't read it, then you're probably missing one of the most exposing documents out there that helps everybody start to understand how we've all been misinformed and we've been lured, or I should say lulled, into these warm feelings about these old archaic government forms. Oh, that we're to have a biblical constitution and the Bible is the basis of our, Christians want to believe that. Christians love to, that makes them feel good, especially when they're thinking about their Bible. But the reality is, whose Bible are we going to follow? And that's the beautiful thing that the divine hand of providence gave us, was a system that would not be based on the factions of the Bible and doctrines. It would ensure that every individual could actually develop their own relationship and their own doctrines and understanding their God and following Him and living by Him. And it's only through a free academic environment where we can actually have open, educated discussion on Christianity. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I get involved with people talking and they're locked in their paradigm. They're not talking academically. Now, I understand that academic doesn't expose and is not driven by the Spirit. But if we have conversations with other people, you know, we may want to actually have the Spirit, but I believe that as long as we're open and objective with other people, we can actually start learning how we can agree and help. Once we start agreeing on what the real truths are, we can actually start, you know, unifying. But there's the problem. I can't unify with these guys. I mean, look at the cross. They have a cross that's upside down. Our cross is right side up. And, you know, I only make fun because we are that stupid. I mean, we the people allow ourselves to be misled by the spirit of contention. Every turn, every corner I take, I see more contention on a different sphere, a different level, in a different sphere. I'm sorry. Anyway, so let me dive into the closing of the Preemptive Act. And then what I'm going to do is I'm going to turn my focus on what we call the Northwest Ordinance. And maybe what I need to do is dive into, but I already did this. I already dove into the Northwest Ordinance and why counties matter most. So I don't want to necessarily dive into it, but what I want to do is highlight what they're doing in the Enabling Acts in pointing to the Northwest Ordinance. So, okay, so let me get back to where we kind of stopped. We were in section 16, and this is where, you know, let me just start it all over again because I have 10 minutes, I can get through this. And this is the starting off at the section 16. Now, I've already read this, but I'm going to do it again. And be it further enacted that the 2% of the proceeds of the land sold, remember, this is the Ponzi scheme that they're setting up, 2% of the land sold or that may hereby or hereafter be sold by the United States in the state of Mississippi. Now, hold on here. This is the Preemptive Act. Since the first day of December, I thought this was the Enabling Act. Now, this is the Preemptive Act that they're, so this is where they're talking about selling the roads and lands and so forth in doing these things. This is 1841. Mississippi became a state, what, in 1817? I think so, because I think Indiana became a state in 1816, or the Enabling Act went out for them to start doing that. And so I think 1817, 1818 is when it literally became a state. And we'll dive into the Enabling Act, because you'll actually see that even though the date of the Enabling Act didn't secure it, when you get into the Enabling Act, it doesn't happen until the delegates in the convention decide to move forward in creating the state. And it's only after they pass the Constitution does the state get created and is a joint, because what Congress is doing is not writing a blank check. They're writing a very specific contract, and they're playing shenanigans that are just absolutely mind-boggling to see exactly how the federal government started subjugating the new states joining the Union and how they went back to the other states that joined the Union prior to the Indiana and Louisiana, because they started including Ohio. They started including some of these other states, because the Kentucky and Tennessee already had major road projects in expanding and moving the movement of commerce into those states and into the old states, so that they could interface commerce-wise and government-wise and so forth. So anyway, get back to this. So the land sold since the first day of December, 1878, by the act, entitled, "An Act Enable the People of the Western Part of the Mississippi Territory to Form a Constitution and State Government, and for the Admission of Such State into the Union on an Equal Footing with the Original States," close quote. In that close quote, that basically says, oh, they're just entering with equal footing, and no. There are these stipulations that are actually taking away their equal footing, where the federal government is creating this ability to start managing and creating this highway system, canal system, or what have you, to help benefit this state, when the federal government does not have that responsibility in admitting states into the Union. This is why we have emphatically gone through this. They have no ability to actually dictate all of the things that they were dictating. They basically, you had to choose what kind of government, a republic, but it had to be Republican in form. Were you going to be a slave state, a free state, or what have you? You had the full breadth and the full freedom to self-determine how you were going to become a state. The burden of interfacing, creating the road systems. Now, as a territory, the federal government has the ability to actually, you know, create roads, trails, what have you, whatever they wanted to call as a road, because back in those days, just, you know, a clearing in the ground where you can kind of, you know, move a wagon, that was considered a road. It's not a, you know, bituminous, a compacted bituminous surface like some of the country roads we have, where you put out gravel and the oil or petroleum bases on top of that, and then more gravel so that it becomes a compacted bituminous surface. And that way you kind of have a real road that weeds and trees won't grow in the middle of. So anyway, going on, it says, "And all acts supplement thereto reserved for the making of road and roads leading to said state, be and the same is hereby relinquished to the state of Mississippi, payable in two equal installments, the first to be paid on the 1st of May, 1842, and the other on the 1st of May, 1843, so far as the same may then have accrued, and quarterly as the same may accrue after said period." That's where I stopped. To finish this up, and see, this was a mind-blowing thing, because this is where they were actually, in 1841, talking about the Ponzi scheme, including Mississippi. And Mississippi was, you know, well before 1820. See, I was thinking 1820 was where they started playing these shenanigans. And apparently, the president never, and the courts never held Congress accountable to getting outside of the responsibilities of admitting new states into the Union by manipulating and controlling them. They should have been called out. They should have been, you know, keel-hauled. Anyway, back to finishing Section 16. "Provided that the legislature of said state shall first pass an act declaring their acceptance and of said relinquishment in full of said fund accrued and accruing, and also embracing a provision to be unalterable without the consent of Congress, that the whole of the said 2% fund shall be faithfully applied to the construction of a road leading from Brandon in the state of Mississippi to the eastern boundary of said state, in the direction as may be of the towns of Selma, Cahaba, and Montgomery in the state of Alabama. So in other words, they had to basically create these roads that were going to go towards this these couple of towns in Alabama. They had no authority to do this. Right, wrong, or indifferent, whether it was nice to do, they did it in fraud. They actually started playing a fraud game in taking land that they couldn't control and said, we're going to sell this, and with the proceeds, we're going to make the money, and with some proceeds, this small stipend, we're going to actually help pay for the roads. What happened to the rest of that money? Where did the rest of the money go? Well, we already know, we read earlier, that some of the money is going into D.C. for the education system and for the governing and establishing this elaborate government and bureaucracy that they had every intention to create. Huh. Now, I don't think they have the power to create those types of taxes, those types of burdens, independently on individual states. If you really understand the uniformity clause right there in Article 1, Section 8, that they have the power to lay direct taxes, imposts, and excise taxes. But they don't have the power to actually put land taxes upon states, which is exactly what they did. So where did they get this idea? Ah, the Northwest Ordinance. So let me finish with Section 17. We got about 2.5 minutes. I won't get through all of this. And be it further enacted that the 2% of the net proceeds of the land sold by the United States in the state of Alabama since the first day of September 1819 and reserved by the act entitled, quote, an act to enable the people of the Alabama Territory to form a constitution and state government and for the admission of such state into the union on an equal footing with the original states. Okay, so boom, we got that where we have the Enabling Act of Alabama. And on top of that, they're basically saying that the proceeds of land sold in the state of Alabama is something that, okay, this is something that they agreed upon moving forward. For the making, after the Enabling Act, close quote, for the making of roads or roads leading to the said state B, and the same is hereby relinquished to the said state of Alabama, payable in two equal installments. The first be paid on the first day of May 1842, and the other on the first day of May 1843, so far as the same may have accrued and quarterly as the same may thereafter accrue, provided that the state legislature, this is the kicker right here, that the state, provided that the state legislature shall first pass an act declaring their acceptance and said relinquishment and also embracing a provision to be unalterable without the consent of Congress. In other words, they're really leaning hard on them and saying, we're putting strings upon you that you can't get out of. That the whole of the said 2% shall be faithfully applied under the direction of the legislature of Alabama to the connection by some means of internal improvements of the navigable waters of the Bay of Mobile and with the Tennessee River. Now, where's the Bay of Mobile? Now, I got to look at this. Is that the Gulf of Mexico? I don't know. With the Tennessee River and the construction of a continuous line of internal improvements from a point on the Chattahoochee River opposite West Point in Georgia across the state of Alabama and in a direction to Jackson in the state of Mississippi. So we just basically finished. We're going into a hard break. So now the reality is this. Everybody wants and everybody looks at the Northwest Ordinance as this sacred document that actually established the admission of states into the Union. And actually it was preempted and actually it was superseded by the passing of the Constitution and the process of admitting states. We'll dive into this when we come back. We'll be right back after this. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance.
In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the republic review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so one of the things I'm struggling with is, do I actually go through, because there are 14 sections of the Northwest Ordinance, and there are lots of manipulations that the Constitution forbids the federal government in doing. Each state is to join the union with equal footing. Now, they have the responsibility of making sure that the state can actually support itself, which is why they started setting this population standard. But to be clear, the federal government had this initiative, they had this, I'll just say, this impetus that for them to start creating more revenue, they needed more states in the union. They realized, probably, with some of the states that were joining in the territories that were not as developed. Now, Ohio was pretty developed. Louisiana was pretty developed. But they realized that maybe Indiana wasn't. I think over time they started realizing, yeah, we need to probably have about 60,000. So that's, over time, they started setting better parameters in ensuring that a state coming into the union was going to be able to support itself. But to create parameters or to create any holdbacks where a state does not have the ability to determine and holding them completely liable to the federal government is not something that they have the authority to do. Therefore, the challenge for conservative thinking people is to go, why is it that I look at the Northwest Ordinance as the definitive doctrine in admitting states into the union instead of letting states join the union with full determination? Why would this manipulation be, this is where the Bible, they were setting the Bible in here, right? And they were giving everybody this feeling of, because they even say here in section 13 that the permanent government therein and for their admission to share in the federal council on an equal footing with the original states at as early period as may consist with the general interest. Now, when we look at the Bible, where did they mention the Bible? And let me see here. S-C-H-O-O-L. And so religion, morality, and knowledge being necessary to good government and the happiness of mankind, schools and the means of education shall forever be encouraged. The utmost good faith shall always be observed towards the Indians. Their lands and property shall never be taken from them without their consent, and their property rights and liberty. So in other words, this was actually opening a can of worms, saying that, we're going to invoke the Northwest Ordinance, but we're not going to invoke this standard on Indians. We're going to move them. We're going to get them out of there. We're going to contain them. I could go through this, but I would invite you to read the Northwest Ordinance. Now, if it becomes necessary, because we need to go into this, I use this the Northwest Ordinance in why counties matter most. And I highlighted those things that they were doing in the Enabling Act, referencing the Northwest Ordinance as violations of the Constitution, because the Constitution superseded the ability to create these types of restrictions, that the states would have full determination. That's why the language in Article 3, Section 4, second paragraph, states that the federal government, and actually, it's probably best that I actually dive into the color-coded Constitution and actually tell you that Article 4, Section 3, the second portion of Section 3, I should say, says the Congress shall have the power to dispose of and make all needful rules and regulations respecting the territory, not respecting the state. They can make no rules or regulations respecting a state. But yet, in the Enabling Acts, they're creating rules and regulations. They didn't do that all the way up to Louisiana, a foreign state. And the only regulations that they injected into the Enabling Act of Louisiana were those unique parameters that were established by the Louisiana Treaty of 1803 regarding taxation and commerce within the port and within that territory. So in other words, they had to make sure that when, even though they became a state and had self-determination, they did create, because they had the authority to create the treaty with France and Spain and basically give them, you know, I think a time window of 10 years. I forget what it was. We covered it in the Louisiana Enabling Act. And the bottom line is that they had to include those things because these states had, or I should say, France and Spain had a right to be able to expect this very specific treatment because it was done with a legitimate treaty. Therefore, the treaty became the supreme law of the land, and they needed to make sure that Louisiana was all on board with this. Now, newer states that came in, like Alabama, or I should say Mississippi and other states to the north along the Mississippi River, they weren't held to that because I do not believe that there was any language in that territory, because we went through the Louisiana Treaty. And in the Louisiana Territory, I don't believe that there was an extension of free passage of commerce deeper up the Mississippi. Anyway, my point is this, is that we have to really dive into what they had the authority to do in the Enabling Acts. This is where we prove that they used the Northwest Ordinance nefariously to actually start creating a Ponzi scheme. And when you look at it, you're looking at the proceeds being paid. 2% of the proceeds are being sent out to the state. Hold on here. State property being held by the federal government in Indiana, as well as in Mississippi, and every new state that joined the union afterwards, they started holding public land, and they would sell the land and pocket it. This became a new tax where the federal government started becoming richer and richer. This goes back to the Virginia ratification debates and why, when we get to this, I'm gonna jump up and down. I mean, folks, I don't cover these things every day. In other words, this is a year worth of content. This is a year worth of education that everybody needs to hear, read through, if you want to have a profound understanding of what the Constitution is and how the federal government is violating it. There's no other way around this. You have to read these things so that you can actually speak to them. Now, if you don't need to, now you can give us blind faith. I beg you to not take my word for it. The last thing I want is somebody to start applying blind faith. However, I acknowledge that 80% of America will not take the time to learn and understand these things. And so that's why 80% of America give blind faith to whom? Blind faith to the parties. And the part, they just basically vote down the party line. They do what the party tells them to do. Pretty much. When you really look at how the votes come in, pretty much 80% of the people, you know, because how many people really vote for third party candidates? It's well under 20%. Well under 20%. There's only been points in time where somebody like Ross Perot or somebody else would come along and actually get, you know, a maybe a two-digit bump in or a two-digit voter turnout. I think Perot, I think, did get a 2% digit, or I think it was over 10% in the voting. I'd have to go back. I do remember that Clinton had 39%, and I do know that Bush was in either the low 30s or upper 20s, and Perot, I think, had it two digits. So the point is, folks, that why is it that you are giving blind faith to the party in how we're going to be governed instead of you understanding what the government is supposed to be doing? Because this critical part of the Declaration of Independence is by the consent of the governed. By you just giving blind faith and applying, you know, this blind trust to the parties, they don't deserve your blind trust. And you need to get that through your head. You have to give blind trust to somebody. At least trust the guy that says, I don't want it. Or at least trust the people and organizations that say, we don't want it. We want you to know exactly why this is going down this way. And so this has been a big epiphany, because at the beginning, it's actually over the past of the course few years, or the course of the past few years, I'm sorry. My head's going a little bit too fast for me today. So, over the course of the past few years, I thought, and I never took the time to read, and I've been on front, I always thought that the Organic Act of 1871 was the, you know, the cream on the top, where the federal government just started doing things well beyond. No, they started doing things well beyond that was not involved with Britain and Britain's manipulation, other than possibly a few agents like Hamilton and others that were helping assist in how to start operating in violation of the Constitution, where nobody would even challenge you. Because why is it that Madison, and technically in the Indiana Enabling Act, when that went out towards the end of the year, that doesn't get signed by the president. That's an act that is done by Congress that actually goes out and, you know, is laid out, because it's not a federal law that's per se, you know, being applied in, you know, every state. It is strictly an enabling of a particular territory to become a state. That is strictly a Congress responsibility. So I don't believe Madison was really privy to what they were doing and what they were planning. He may have, and he may have just shook his head. I don't know. I do know that he wasn't, I mean, he was very aggressive in defending his honor, and he was very aggressive in defending the Constitution. And he actually spoke out heavily about those things that were degenerations and subversions of the Constitution. I find it interesting how he didn't dive into these enabling acts. But I do say, I can say this, that in 1816, when Congress gave him the bonus bill, I think that what he gave them back in 1817 should have resolved the issue, because he said that they don't have the authority to actually start regulating roads for the Union, going into new states or existing states, period. That they just really don't have that authority. That they need to, he encouraged them to go amend the Constitution. Well, they were getting away with it in the Enabling Act. They were still trying to do it as a legitimate function, because once they can do it legitimately, then it's all said and done. And so Monroe basically said, well, you can't do that, But Monroe never challenged them on all these new states under his watch that were joining the Union, such as Mississippi. I think Monroe, if he found out, you know, Indiana, Mississippi, Missouri, all of these types of things were happening as a part of their joining the Union, that Congress kind of hoodwinked him and said, look, you know, we have the ability to do this when these new states come in, because the Ponzi scheme started on Monroe's watch. Now, this may be a quid pro quo, because you've heard me say that Monroe actually violated the Constitution on his own by basically extraditing, or actually freeing, all the free blacks, the freeman blacks that were in America. He basically sent them to Liberia, bought Liberia, and sent them there so that they could create a new nation for themselves, because he felt that they didn't have a chance here. He understood that they cannot regulate, you know, morals. They cannot regulate behavior of people. So let's give these people really a good start and an opportunity to, you know, to govern themselves. They deserve that. And that's what he did. Now, I'm kind of curious what the divisive racists out there that like to, you know, raise the race card out every time they can. I wonder what they think about this, because you never hear them talk about that. You know, how Monroe actually spent the money to actualize Jefferson's idea and plan. But Monroe was in that position. He was able to spend that money because they were aggressively bringing money in to pay off the debt. And they were making those margins, and he still had enough margin on the money coming in to basically pay for Liberia and send the black freemen there to create a new state. The reality is this, folks. I don't think Monroe necessarily, you know, because obviously he didn't stop Congress. He didn't step up and say, hey, look, I see what you're doing. Because he actually vetoed the Cumberland Gap Bill in 1822. So why did he allow this Ponzi scheme to be established? Well, it benefited the states. And this is the danger of thinking it's okay to create infractions if everybody benefits. But everybody didn't benefit. New York wasn't benefiting. Well, maybe so with the commerce coming through their state, but how about Pennsylvania? You know, how about New Jersey? How about these smaller states that weren't bringing commerce in and out? They were basically just kind of doing their own. How did they benefit? And the reality is, when we look at what the federal government was doing and how they set this all up, the big hole that they punched in the Constitution. And started manipulating states, which basically led and created the justification for this huge bureaucracy management of the Department of Home, what we call the Department of Interior today. When we really look at why did they create that in 1849? Well, because they had every intention of being, they're holding all this public land to sell. And they're only on the hook of giving up to a 2% to the states. Where's the rest of that money going? Where's the rest of the proceeds going? This is why reading the ratification debates will really help you understand that they should never have been doing these things. They had no authority, as well as the Constitutional Convention. Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention help highlight this as well. So as we move forward, let me just dive into the Mississippi Enabling Act, because I think that that's really where we need to go. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to basically highlight parts of this. Be it enacted by the Senate and House. Now, this is like the first time, you know, they started using Senate and House instead of Congress. Of the United States in Congress assembled, that the inhabitants of the western part of the Mississippi Territory and they hereby are authorized to form for themselves a constitution and state, and as to assume such name as they deem proper. And the said state, when formed, shall be admitted into the Union upon the same equal footing with the original states in all respects whatsoever. And be it further enacted that the said states, let me see here if I got this in PDF. Yeah, there we go. I'm going to open this up with PDF. It's just a little easier because the language doesn't get kind of, I'll just say, twisted. I was reading it from a transposed Word or PDF to Word. So anyway, and it be further enacted that the state shall consist of all the territory included. This is where they go through the boundaries of down to the Gulf of Mexico. So they were recognizing the Gulf of Mexico. So the Bay of Mississippi or what have you was, or I think it was the Bay of Alabama or Montgomery, whatever. Anyway, so they in section two, they lay out the boundaries. It's typical. I'm not going to read that. Three, and it be further enacted that all free white male citizens of the United States, so this is when they started actually putting race to it, because the federal government could not actually determine what, you know, all free men were supposed to be able to vote, period. Because if you've got apportionment, you got representation. And I identified this. I believe this is in Why Counties Matter Most, when the states actually started playing games with the freemen, the black freemen, and taking away the right to vote. New York started doing it in the early 1800s. And many of the states started doing this to where the federal government just started applying this, that only free white males. And basically suppressing or oppressing women, because in some states, some women were allowed. They were setting a unconstitutional standard because they couldn't actually dictate how states were to run their elections, period. And they were doing it. This had to be a part of an amendment, not this act of enabling act. Anyway, and resided within the said territory at least 1 year previous to the time of holding election, and shall have paid a county or territorial tax, and all persons having in other respects the legal qualifications to vote for representatives in the General Assembly of the said territory be, and they are hereby authorized to choose representatives to form a convention who shall be apportioned among the several counties within the said territory as follows, to wit, from the county of Warren too, and they go through all the different counties, and I would highly recommend that if you're from this state, or when you're looking at your state, you actually kind of look through how they divvied it all up, because it was all by county. These were representatives of the county, and each county had equal voice. Okay, just like the U.S. Senate, the concept of having equal voice in creating the Constitution, because they were all equal parties to it. That's the defining factor. As a county, you're creating a state. It doesn't matter how many people you have. You are a legitimate government. And you have the authority to have equal voice in creating that state. That's how the conventions were designed. That's how this nation was built. Anyway, let me dive into the next one, Section 4. Because they kind of go through the laws of regulating representatives, all that. And he says, Section 4, and to be further enacted, that the members of the convention thus duly elected be, and they hereby are authorized to meet at the town of Washington on the first day, Monday, in July next. Okay, so this means that the convention was to be held in July 1817 and to be determined. So this is the whole point. Which convention when meet shall first determine by a majority of the whole number elected whether it be or not be expedient at that time to form a constitution and state government for the people within the said territory. And if it be determined to be expedient, the convention shall be and hereby are authorized to form a constitution and state government, provided that the same, when formed, shall be republican and not repugnant to the principles of the ordinance. Now, this is the whole point right here. This is where they inject the Northwest Ordinance. that the, okay, provided that the same, when formed, shall be Republican and not repugnant to the principles, not repugnant to the Constitution, but repugnant to the principles of the ordinance of the 13th of July, 1787. That is the Northwest Ordinance. Between the people and states of the territory northwest of the River Ohio, so far as the same has been extended to the said territory by the Articles of Agreement between the United States and the state of Georgia, or of the Constitution of the United States. This is how they started twisting. So when did they bring Georgia into the Union? Because supposedly that's when they started doing this. And Georgia, let me see here. When did Georgia join the, oh, well, talk about a brain fart. So Georgia was a part of the Union already. So Georgia could not have been in agreement on its own to actually inject the Northwest Territory. So I have no idea why they were referencing this, other than they probably just created this facade that Georgia had basically agreed to this. And so, let me see here. The agreement between the United States and the state of Georgia, or of the Constitution of the United States. But the Constitution of the United States did not allow them to do this. And provided also that the said convention shall provide by an ordinance irrevocable without the consent of the United States, that the people inhabiting the said territory do agree and declare that they forever disclaim all right or title to the waste or unappropriated lands lying within the said territory, and that the same shall... So, in other words, they're getting them. They have no authority to say this, that the people of the state, if it's not claimed, it basically makes that federal land. How did they do this? Well, they put it in this thing. And then when the people of the territory looked at that and go, hold on here, you're doing something that you don't have the authority to do. Who dare challenge them? How dare they? When they got Indiana to do this, it made it, and every state, because they use this coercion, oh, well, you want to become a state? You want to be sovereign? You got to do this. So bottom line, right there is your smoking gun. Right there, they basically told the state that they had to subjugate themselves to the United States. So how is it that Mississippi, Indiana became equally footed states when they were subjugated to the United States unconstitutionally and none of the other states were? So folks, this is when they created this layout of a Ponzi scheme. And actually, as we go through this, we're going to see how all of the states coming into the Union started participating in the Ponzi scheme. And as the states later and later joined the Union, because the federal government was becoming richer and richer, they basically started stealing more and more of the sovereignty away from the Western states. We'll dive back more into this on Friday, but I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.